10 years after her death, that a selection of Mother Teresa's personal letters that she had written to a confidant were published. And the book was called Come Be My Light. Many of us, in fact, probably all of us, know of Mother Teresa. We would recognize her wrinkled smile, her wrinkled hands. We know of her work in Calcutta, India, where she lived for most of her life, going out into the streets and bringing those who were dying into hospice care so they could be cared for with dignity and with love and with grace. But none of us could have known the inner truth about her spiritual hardships. Her letters, however, revealed that for almost a full 50 years, she struggled with a deep darkness in her soul. I've pulled a few excerpts from her letters so that you could hear her words this morning. She wrote once, "I am told that God lives in me, and yet the reality of darkness and coldness and emptiness is so great that nothing touches my soul. I feel just that terrible pain of loss, of God not wanting me, of God not being God, of God not really existing. Darkness is such that I really do not see, neither with my mind nor with my reason, the place of God in my soul is blank. There is no God in me when the pain of longing is so great." And perhaps one of my favorite phrases, she said, "If I were ever to become a saint, I will surely be one of darkness. I will continually be absent from heaven to light the light of those in darkness on the earth." She reported that there was only one short break of this season of darkness over her life, and that came in 1958, and it lasted a mere 5 weeks. But other than that, for 50 years, she lived with this feeling of absence of God, this profound separation from God, and she says that she lived in a great spiritual darkness. Now, this is Mother Teresa, the one whom we look to for inspiration, the one who brought so many people to faith, the one who cared for so many, the one who we call the living saint while she was among us. We have a term for what she battled. We call it the dark night of the soul. It was actually coined by St. John of the Cross, a Spanish monk who lived in the 1500s, who wrote a book called The Dark Night of the Soul after his own season of darkness. Now, when I was thinking of how best to describe the dark night of the soul and what to compare it to and what to not compare it to, I came up with just a silly little comparison, so forgive me. The dark night of the soul is not those country western song seasons of your life. This is not when your girlfriend leaves you and your dog runs away and your new pickup truck gets rear-ended. It's not the country western song season. But the dark night of the soul is something much different. It's a season of being completely lost. Like when Thomas Merton wrote, "My Lord and my God, I have no idea where I am going. I do not see the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will end. And I do not really know myself." It's a season of deep darkness, as we heard Mother Teresa describe when she said, "The darkness is such that I really do not see. The place of God in me is blank." And it's a season like Job went through from our text today, where after losing everything he had, all of his earthly possessions, all of his earthly relationships, he found himself in this place where the absence of God in his life was so profound. He wrote that, "Oh, where I knew where I might find God. If I go forward, God is not there. If I go backwards, I cannot perceive God. On the left, he hides. I cannot behold God. I turn to the right, and I cannot see him." In a dark night of the soul, there is this feeling of profound absence or separation from God that happens no other time in the life of someone who is on this journey of faith. And now here's the funny thing, or perhaps the sad thing, is that as good church folks, we don't talk about this very often. We like to talk about potlucks and fellowship and prayer meetings and Bible studies and garage sales and mission trips, all of those good and wonderful things that we do here. But we keep our dark nights of the soul to ourselves. And really, who can blame us? Because Mother Teresa herself officially requested that all of her letters be burned upon her death. She wanted no one to know that she lived in such a spiritual darkness. And so really, we can be forgiven, because if Mother Teresa doesn't talk about the dark night of the soul, well, we are a little bit justified in being a little bit trepidatious and talking about it as well. But like all things, and I think that I'm hearing a voice of some sassy Southern woman that I grew up with that said this: as with all things, just because we don't speak about it doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. Just because we don't speak about it doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. So this morning, we're going to speak about it. And I give thanks that we're in a congregation where we can hold those dark things and those light things side by side. It's been this weird feeling this morning in worship, because we had all of these kids with us at 9:30, and then here receiving their Bibles and the joy that children bring, and the children sang at 9:30, and then we had Finnegan's baptism, which is just a great moment in the life of any church when a child or an adult is baptized and brought into the faith. But then we have given to us from the lectionary this what I can no better describe as this really awful, rough text from Job 23. And so we decided to hold them side by side, because this is the place where we bring both of those parts of our spiritual lives, and we sit them here together, and we walk together as the community of faith. So I'm grateful that we're holding that tension this morning. So then the question that comes up for me next is, what are we to do? What are we to do in the time of a dark night of the soul? Well, going back to being good church folks, our natural inclination and really our human instincts say, fix it, right? Fix it. Put it in its place. Do something about it. Make it right. And we do this really well. When someone in this congregation is sick, we make them a meal. We find the right medications. We visit. We nurse them back to health. When the flood comes, we go in and we slog through the mud and we tear down the wet walls and we put up dry sheetrock. When somebody is lonely, we go and we sit with them. We call, we text, we write cards. And the joke has been this morning that some of us still know how to write cursive. You can write a card and maybe I'll send the text, because I've forgotten long ago how to write in cursive. But we know what to do when these things happen. But yet somehow when someone is struggling with a spiritual problem, we are less certain of the answer, particularly when it's a dark night of the soul. John Ortberg, in his book Soul Keeping, which we have a group studying on Friday mornings, says that when church folks come upon a spiritual problem, they always seem to think that the answer is more giving, more worship, more studying, more prayer, more reading the Bible. And when they can't fix it that way, they try to fix it by controlling it. We ask ourselves, is this because of something I did? Is this a punishment? Is this a trial? Is this a consequence? One of my favorite preachers, Barbara Brown Taylor, wrote a book called Learning to Walk in the Dark. And in it, she has a whole chapter devoted to the dark night of the soul. And she says this about those questions: is this a trial? Is this a consequence? Is this a punishment? She says that these questions are often a sly way of trying to stay in control of the situation, since the possibility that you have caused it comes with the hope that you can also put it to an end, either by passing the test or enduring the punishment. But yet the darker possibility, she says, is the one that's too frightening to consider, that this night is actually beyond your control. And here's the scary thing. The scary thing is that in a dark night of a soul, there's actually no fixing it. There's no controlling it. There's no explaining it away. Barbara Brown Taylor says that no one chooses the dark night. It simply descends. It descends upon your life. And even when comforting friends come around to see how we're doing, they're about as much help as the friends of Job who came around and visited him on the ash heap. She continues to say that for good or for ill, no one can do your work for you while you're in this dark place. It has your name written all over it, and the only way out is through. The only way out is through. So how do we get through it? When I asked that question at 8 o'clock, I followed it quickly by saying, I'm going to leave that question here because I don't fully know the answer. And there were two or three women and a man sitting over on this side, and they just rolled their eyes and threw their head back like, thanks, Nicole. Just leave the weight of that question. But in all the studying that I've done and all the scriptures that I've read and all of the theologians I've turned to and voices from over the years, there seems to be something important about becoming still and growing quiet when you're in the dark night of a soul. The Bible this morning from Job 23 actually tells us more about what not to do than what to do. And in Job 23, Job rages. He yells at God. He's furious. I picture him tearing his clothes and shaking his fists at the sky. He reminds God of his righteousness, of all the wonderful things he's done, of how he's never done wrong, and how he's remained faithful, even all of these trials. And he demands that God would hear his case. One of my favorite seminary professors used to say this about Job. He said that Job imagines God to be a judge because Job needs God to be a judge. A judge would have to listen to his reason. And then he would yell, enough, Job! God has left the bench, and God has hung up his robes, and God is waiting for us to be quiet. So friends, it seems like part of the answer, maybe not the whole, to that dark night of the soul, to the way through it, is to grow quiet, is to grow still, to get quiet enough to listen, and to simply wait. To simply wait. The honest answer is that no one knows when it will pass. And no one knows when God will reappear again. But this is all a part of being people of faith. We wait patiently. We listen. We grow quiet. Even in the darkness and even in the times when God seems to be absent. I want to close this morning with a modern psalm. And then after I read this psalm, we're going to sit for just a minute in the quietness and in the stillness of this place together, side by side. And as you do, I want to say that I imagine we're sitting here with some of us who are in the middle of their own dark night of the soul. And if that's you, hold closely this fact that it will pass. And if you're somebody that's sitting beside or knows somebody that is in the dark night of the soul, well, then your task is to be gentle and to be patient and to be quiet as well. This psalm was written by Ann Weems in 1982 after the death of her young adult son, which plunged her into her own dark night of the soul. And she wrote this. Oh God, find me. I am lost in the valley of grief, and I cannot see my way out. My friends leave baskets of balm at my feet, but I cannot bend to touch the healing to my heart. They call me to leave this valley, but I cannot follow the faint sound of their voices. They sing their songs of love, but the words fade and vanish in the wind. They knock, but I cannot find the door. They shout to me, but I cannot find the voice to answer. Oh God, find me. Come into this valley and find me. Bring me out of this land, O you whom I belong. Find me. I will wait here, for you have never failed to come to me. I will wait here, for you have always been faithful. I will wait here, for you are my God, and you have promised that you counted the hairs on my head. Amen.